longer I live, the older I get, the more I realize that life is hard and filled with many challenges and many struggles. And on top of it being hard, we live with the consequences of many wrongdoings and many sins and many errors. And I had a friend who said one time that life is hard and then you die. And I'm tempted to believe that sometimes, that life is that hard. And I know that there are many people in the church today, in this congregation of believers, who are experiencing great hardship, or at least know somebody who is experiencing great hardship. And it's as a result of us being this dual-natured being. We're both spirit and body. God gave us a spirit, but He also gave us this body of flesh that we live in, and we shall, until the day we die, have this body of flesh that we dwell in and that we live in. And having a body subjects us to some very predictable side effects. One in particular, which I'm going to dwell on today, which is subjects us to need. If we didn't have this body, we wouldn't need. But as it is, we need food, we need air, we need water, we need sleep, we need clothing, we need shelter, we need companionship, we need affirmation, we need wisdom to know how to live in this earth, and knowledge. And the list of our needs that we have is endless because we have this body of flesh that we live in. And having this body relegates us to a life of need. This need that we have is meant to teach us one thing. It's meant to teach us that above any other need that we have, we need God. And if any of those needs that we have in life go unmet, we begin to suffer, don't we? If we suffer a lack of air, we suffer for a very short period of time, but we do suffer. If we suffer from a lack of food, we suffer for a little bit longer time, but we do suffer. If we suffer from a lack of affirmation, a lack of companionship, the suffering can be great. Can it not? And our body fills us with this lack of need, and when one of those needs go unmet, we suffer. The Bible calls this body of need that we have weakness. It calls it weakness, I think, because it makes us prone to falling into temptation. I'm going to go through a paragraph or a small portion of the Bible that I think displays this whole idea of need and weakness and falling into temptation very, very clearly. And it's that time in the life of Christ where He had just finished the Passover and He is now turning His face towards the cross and He is about to endure the greatest weakness that any man has ever endured. And they go to a place called the Garden of Gethsemane. Matthew, you can follow the story with me in Matthew 26, verse 36 to 46. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and He said to His disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And talking with Him, Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, He began to be sorrowful and troubled. And here we begin to see the great weakness that Christ experienced as He turned His face towards the cross. Then He said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." And as Christ embarked on this journey of weakness, He turns to His disciples and He says, "I want you to watch with me." In some of the texts in the other Gospels, He says, "Watch and pray. I want you to watch and pray with me." And Jesus goes away a little farther and He fell on His face and He prayed, saying, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. And we can see very clearly here the weakness that Jesus felt. The great pull of the flesh to not do what he knew he had to do. And that going to the cross was such an agonizing thing and an agonizing thought for him that he prayed to the Father, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." It's recorded in Luke the great degree of this weakness that Jesus felt and the great degree that with which he was struggling against this weakness. It says that he struggled so hard that he sweat great drops of blood. I don't know about you, but I've never struggled against my weakness that hard. "Nevertheless," he said to God, "not as I will, but as you will." And he came to the disciples and he found them sleeping. Now understand, they had just come from a big meal. They had just spent the night with the Lord celebrating the Passover, which I would take to be a rather large meal. They had just ate some bread and drank some wine and probably a warm night there in Jerusalem. And I would suspect that sleep was coming over them pretty heavy. And that the draw of the flesh to fall asleep was pretty great. But Jesus comes back to his disciples and he finds them sleeping. And he says this to Peter, "So, could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation." You know, it's interesting here to point out that the need for us to be watchful is because of the weakness of the flesh. And the solution is that Jesus tells us to watch and pray. And the reason he tells us to watch and pray is so that we won't enter into temptation. And the great temptation that I think the disciples that Jesus was talking about here was not that the disciples were falling asleep. The great temptation was that they would fall away from Christ and be scattered, was that they would deny Christ or walk away from Christ. I think that is the temptation that Christ is talking about. And that is what he warns them, to watch and pray so that you may not enter into temptation. And then he says these words to the disciples. He says, "The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak." This body of flesh that God has given us has many weaknesses. It needs many things. And one of the things that it needed on the night for the disciples was it needed sleep. And Jesus told them that they needed to watch and pray. But they didn't have the strength to do that. Or they didn't feel that they did anyways. But one thing I want us to understand here from this passage, I think it's very interesting what Jesus says to the disciples. The spirit indeed is willing, he says, but the flesh is weak. Not strong, weak. And he says to the disciples, he tells the disciples that the flesh is not a strong thing. It's not a 280-pound person in a boxing ring with you that you're fighting against. It's a weak thing. You know, I got a dog when I was 13. And this dog went to the vet with me on a number of occasions. And it wasn't apparently a very enjoyable time the first time he went. Because the second time he had to go to the vet, I made the very big mistake of saying "vet" in front of him. And he immediately began to tremble. Honestly, this is a long time apart. And he knew where we were going somehow. But he began to tremble. And I put the leash on him. And I started to take him to the car. And he resisted. Just going like this, shaking all the way to the car as I dragged him to the car to try and get him in the back door. And I think that is the picture of what our flesh is like. It's not that it's this great big strong bully that beats us around and tells us what to do. The flesh is a weakling. The flesh lacks courage. The flesh lacks strength. I think that's the picture that Christ is telling his disciples here. He says the spirit is indeed willing. The spirit wants to get up and serve. The spirit wants to get up and do things. But the flesh is not willing. The flesh is weak. He turned back to the passage again here. And again, for a second time, Jesus went away and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it." Sorry. My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for a third time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. And here we get a picture, a very clear picture, of the strength of Christ. He was in the garden fighting with the weakness of his flesh. The flesh did not want to go to the cross. And yet Christ said, not my will, but your will be done. And notice this, that Christ says, Christ rises up and says, let us be going. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. It wasn't a reluctant willingness on Christ's part. He did not wait for his betrayer to come and find him. He went to his betrayer. He shows us the resolve within him to overcome the weakness of the flesh. And we all know what happens from here, right? Christ is taken before Pilate. And when he was taken, all of his disciples scatter, for they were afraid of being taken as well, along with Christ. But Peter comes back, and he sits around the fire where Jesus' trial is being held. And there, around that little fire, he denies that he knows the Lord Jesus three times. And then when he realizes what he has done, when the cock had crowed three times and he realizes what he had done, he wept bitterly, it says. And I wonder what Peter was feeling at that moment. I wonder what Peter was thinking to himself at that moment when he realized where his weakness had led him. He had failed to stay awake. He had failed to watch and pray. And now he had failed in his obedience to Christ. He had failed to show his allegiance to Christ by following him and going with him. And I wonder what was going through Peter's mind. It's not recorded, at least that I'm aware of, what Peter was thinking. But I'm guessing that he was thinking to himself, that's it. I've rejected Christ. How can God ever accept me now? I failed at the most monumental task that I could have failed at. And how can I be accepted? How can I find acceptance with God now that I've rejected his own son? You know, when we suffer weakness, one of the things that we are very prone to do is to think in our hearts and in our minds that God has rejected us. And really, is that not what the world teaches us? Is that not what we learn by our daily activity in the world? Weak things are rejected. Weak things are abandoned. Weak things are left behind. You know, nobody wants to be the weak wildebeest, right? I mean, I'm thinking of the documentaries on National Geographic. And the narrator says, we are watching a pack of hyenas on the savanna desert. And the hyenas are surrounding the wildebeest, looking for the weak wildebeest. I mean, nobody wants to be the weak wildebeest, right? I mean, nobody wants to be that person. But suffering teaches us that we're weak. And when we're weak, we believe that we've been rejected by God. I got an email from my inspector the other day. I don't know if any of you know the hierarchy or the rank structure in the OPP, but it goes constable, sergeant, staff sergeant, inspector. So I got an email from somebody who ranks four people over me. And if you've ever been in a situation where you work in a rank structure, it's never a good thing to get a personal email from the inspector. There's always a chain of command, and it goes from inspector. If he wants to tell you something, goes to the staff sergeant, which goes to the sergeant, which eventually dribbles down to me, the little constable. And I got an email from the inspector the other day. And I tell you, it's kind of like going to the principal's office and getting called to the principal's office. You know, either someone in your family is dead or you're about to be dead. And I saw his name there on the email and I thought, well, this is not good. And I opened it and it was one sentence long. This is even worse. And it basically said, you messed up. And without going into the details, the boring details, I was immediately crushed by that. And I'm sure some of you, maybe, have had that experience before, seeing as we all have flesh. I was immediately crushed, and I immediately had this sense that my inspector detested me, and that he would reject me based upon my error. And I'll be honest, I could hear the axe sharpening in the background of him wanting to get rid of me off of his team. And I was thinking to myself, weak wildebeest, weak wildebeest, weak wildebeest. And I immediately sensed that he detested me. So I thought to myself, okay, how am I going to deal with this problem? So I thought, well, the best thing I can do is apologize. So I sent an apology back to him and I said, I'm sorry, I apologize, it won't happen again. And I expected to hear at least something back from him, and I waited and waited and waited, and of course 5 minutes seems like an hour, which seems like a year. And I waited for a response, I never heard anything, so I thought, what should I do? Like, I don't know what to do here. And I thought, well, accept responsibility, take responsibility for what you've done. So I sent back another email, and I said, is there anything I can do to mitigate my error? And right away, he sent back a reply, and he said, no worries, problem solved, live and learn. And it was those words, to me, they took me from like anxiety up here to no anxiety whatsoever in those simple words that he spoke. And in retrospect, I was looking back at that as I was preparing for this sermon, I was looking back at that, and I was thinking to myself, what transaction took place there? What happened in that transaction that brought me from thinking I was going to be rejected, that brought me from the point of thinking he hated me, to the point of thinking, hey, everything's going to be okay. And I think it was simply this. He had sympathy towards me. He said in a matter of speaking that he understood my weakness. He understood my problem, that he had been there himself, and that it's okay. So he understood me, and he had sympathy towards me. You know, sympathy is a universal sign of acceptance. It's a universal sign that we are not going to be rejected. Without sympathy, we can never be confident that we've been accepted. Sympathy is like the wagging tail on a dog in some respects. Excuse me for using all these dog images today, but I'm going to go down this path again. My kids have wanted a dog for a long time. And up until now, I've been strong. I've been resisting. They're not getting a dog. And as a result of their desire for a dog, our neighborhood is filled with people that somehow find the time to take care of a dog and children. And they walk by our house every day. And there's probably three or four people that very frequently walk by our house. And every time they walk by with the dog, their 20-minute walk turns into a 45-minute walk because my kids all flood out the door. They want to pet the dog that's walking by on the street. And there's one dog in particular. His name is Rudy. And he's this ugly bulldog. And my kids, the first time they saw him, he's walking by, and the kids run out to go and pet this dog. And the dog growls at them. And the master says, oh, don't worry, he won't bite you. And my kids are going, yeah, right, I don't buy that. And probably rightly so, because the outward display was that you're not going to pet me. The outward display is I've not accepted you. But sympathy is a wagging dog, a wagging tail on a dog. And it tells us that everything is going to be all right. It's a sign of acceptance. Sympathy is the outward demonstration that we have not been rejected. In essence, with God, it's a smiling face. It's an open arms. And that leads us to the very heart of our message today. That one of the hallmarks of Jesus' ministry on earth was the fact that he was sympathetic. You know, the King James Version translates the word sympathy as being touched with the feeling of another. It means he felt what you feel. In another word, the Bible uses to communicate the same idea as this word compassion. I think we've heard it from this pulpit before that compassion actually translated means bowels. It means spleen. And it's the bowels or the spleen have always been thought throughout history as that which is the seat of the emotions, where our emotions come from. And it means that you have a great feeling or you're moved with compassion, you're moved with feeling towards a person and they're hurt. And the Bible uses the word compassion at least 14 times or a variation of that word, at least 14 times, and almost every instance of that use of that word is in the gospel when it's talking about Jesus Christ and his compassion for the people. Matthew 9 verse 36 says this, when Jesus, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Mark gives the indication that they were lacking in knowledge, but they lacked wisdom. Because they lacked wisdom, they were wandering around like sheep without a shepherd. They had no one teaching them. And instead of saying to them, you should have been up earlier, reading your scrolls, if you hadn't been doing that, you wouldn't be in the situation that you're in right now. It doesn't say that. He says he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And then Mark goes on to tell us that he got up and he taught them. Matthew 14, verse 14 says, when he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. Again, they were living in situations in which they were ill, and he doesn't scold them or chide them for not eating their vegetables or anything like that. He has compassion on them and he heals them. Matthew 13, verse 32, then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And I am unwilling to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way. And we see through the life of Jesus' ministry on earth that he was moved with compassion many, many times for the people that he dealt with. And he felt sympathy for them. And that sympathy was what drew huge crowds to him. I'm sure that's what it was. Was the fact that he understood them and he had compassion on them. And yet he was a great leader. And it drew, that compassion drew the crowds to him. So what is the same? That's the way Jesus was in the Bible. That's what we read about when he lived here on earth. The same is this. The Lord Jesus Christ is full of sympathy for his people. And sympathy is based on this idea of personal experience. And there's a song that was written a number of years ago, and it was called One of Us, and you've probably heard it. I think it was a song for a TV show as well. It says, what if God was one of us, just a slob like one of us, just a stranger on the bus trying to make his way home? And however wrong or right the lyrics may be in that song, it recognizes that compassion and sympathy is something that is learned by a common experience. Isaiah 53 verse 3 prophesied that Christ himself would experience what we experienced. It says, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. It means he would live the life that we lived in the flesh, and he would suffer like we suffer in the flesh, and more than we will ever suffer. And just as Jesus was sympathetic and full of compassion towards people's weakness during his earthly ministry, so he remains sympathetic with us today. Hebrews 4 verse 14 to 15 says this, since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who in every respect has been tempted and yet without sin. Jesus came to earth and took on this, humiliated himself and took on this body of flesh and lived a life of sorrow and grief. And then he died on the cross and rose again from the dead. He passed through the heavens, the writer of Hebrews says. And now he sits at God's right hand. And he sits at God's right hand not as our accuser, not as the person who points out every sin that we've done and says, you've done this and this and this and this and this and this, and overwhelms us with guilt. That's the role of Satan, is it not? He sits there as our advocate, as someone who sympathizes with our weakness. Notice that he does not sympathize with our sin, but he sympathizes with our weakness, it says. And what's the good that can come from that? The good is this, that we will not be forsaken. The great temptation in our weakness is to believe that God has rejected us. And if we believe that God has rejected us, we turn our backs on Him and we fail to come to Him to find help in our time of need, the only person that can truly help us. I'm just going to read a series of verses from you, and I want you to pay attention to them. I'm not going to have any commentary through them. I'm just going to read them as they are. And let the Word of God speak to your heart this morning. 1 John 2 verse 1 says this, "My little children, I am writing these things to you so that you may not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. Let us then, with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Hebrews 5 verse 2, "He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since He Himself is beset with weakness." Hebrews 7 verse 25, "Consequently, He is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through Him, since He always lives to make intercession for them." So we see that Christ is sympathetic to our weakness, and He is sympathetic for one reason, and one reason alone that I can think of, so that we will have confidence to come before God and find help in our time of need. So, what need do you have this week? What weakness has been your ever-present friend? And how is that weakness tempting you to sin and to fall away from the living God? Are you doubting the goodness of God towards you? Hebrews 5, verse 7 to 8 says this, "In the days of His flesh, in the days of Jesus' flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears." And you can picture Him in the Garden of Gethsemane, can you not? "To Him who was able to save Him from death, and He was heard because of His reverence. Although He was a son, He learned obedience from what He suffered." It is our weakness that teaches us to depend upon God. It is our weakness that teaches us to obey Him. So I give you this as your only assignment today, and for as long as we call it today, to look full into the face of Christ, who has experienced greater weakness than you have ever experienced, and yet without sin, and to hear His sympathetic voice saying to you, "I know what it is to be weak. I know what it is to suffer. Now come and follow Me." The Lord is full of sympathy for whatever weakness you may be experiencing today. He is the smiling face of God and an ever-present reminder that whatever you are experiencing, the Lord's intentions towards you are good. The challenge today is to go forward and to not doubt the Lord's good intentions towards you. Let's pray.